A $7 million ad campaign from the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is trying to lure young adults from Chicago to live in Wisconsin. One of the main selling points, Wisconsin's lower cost of living. That got our friends at WisContext thinking about how the numbers stack up and what really goes into figuring out the cost of living from one area to another. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of WisContext.org. Scott, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, cost of living, I will admit, Scott, I see this phrase in a report on the economy or whatever, newspaper reporting, and I think it means something very specific. I assume that the economists of the world have one agreed on definition and it's universal. It's more complicated, it turns out.
Yeah, it turns out to be fuzzier than I expected when I started looking into this, because you just hear it talked about so much in terms of the decisions that people make and that policymakers and businesses make, about what they're doing, especially when it comes to geography. So, yeah, it turns out it's not a super hard and fast sort of thing.
And we want to compare and contrast sometimes, like this new ad that Wisconsin, the Economic Development Corporation, is airing down in Chicago. One of the selling points for Wisconsin is, hey, it's cheaper to live here. The cost of living is lower. So you looked into some of the different measurements on that. What kind of things did you find out? Is it cheaper to live here than Chicago?
Yes, it's undeniably cheaper to live just about anywhere in Wisconsin than in Chicago, you know, and of course the difference there, depending on how someone's calculating it, can vary quite a bit. And obviously, depending on what kind of lifestyle you're expecting to live in one place or another and what kinds of trade-offs that you're willing to make.
Who is out there measuring cost of living? There are a bunch of different official and private sources, right?
Yeah, and the one that seems to be kind of the industry standard, or at least close to it, is something called the Council on Community and Economic Research, which goes by C2ER for short. And they issue a quarterly cost of living index, which is sort of a calculation of the price of a bunch of different sorts of wants and needs, weighted differently across, you know, many different metro areas in the United States.
Let's look into what goes into the numbers there and maybe some other sources. It seems like one universal, and this makes sense, everybody's got to live somewhere. So housing costs figure in pretty dramatically on cost of living.
Right. That's the big one. You know, it's the most important factor for just about anyone making a credible calculation about cost of living. And, you know, often that'll be combined with other sorts of essentials like the cost of utilities and healthcare, various measures of the costs of transportation and things like that. And, you know, in the case of C2ER, for example, they'll also factor in sort of different things that, you know, you could either consider necessities or luxuries, it can be about 60 things, and they'll change it a bit over time. You know, obviously the core things like housing will remain the same, but you know, there can be things in there like bowling or tennis balls or a drop-in yoga session, and these are in their formula weighted a lot lower than something like housing, of course, but it's an attempt of sorts to sort of capture the mix of goods and services that, you know, a typical family might be buying in a given place.
Right. Bowling seems very specific, or yoga class, but maybe that's a stand-in for the cost of recreation in an area.
Right. I mean, you've got to assume that people are going to spend some money on leisure activities or, you know, luxuries or indulgences of one kind or another.
Talking to Scott Gordon from WisContext about how we measure cost of living and then how we use that to compare, say, Wisconsin versus Chicago. And you put this to the test, Scott, and ran different cities compared with Chicago through some of the different online measurements of cost of living. They didn't all come out with the same numbers. There were some fairly significant differences, right?
Right. And to clarify, this wasn't a story where we did a whole lot of our own hardcore number crunching, but I wanted to look at some of these kind of consumer-facing personal finance websites that help try to help people understand the differences of cost of living in different cities. So there's CNN Money has one. There's a site called Nerd Wallet. There's this other site called Sperling's Best Places, and they each have calculators or comparisons of a different kind where you can enter two different cities and sort of get, you know, well, a $50,000 salary in this place equals a $56,000 salary in another place. And again, you know, every time through, yes, it's Chicago is going to be more expensive to live than Milwaukee or Madison or somewhere else in Wisconsin for the most part, but we did find some variations and, you know, and some different kind of source material that people were drawing on.
Looking at who the Wisconsin ads are targeting in Chicago, it's not generic person. They seem to be targeting, as I understand it, younger people looking to go into professional careers, right? Does that sway our cost of living measurements at all?
Well, I think it highlights the fact that when you are using a number like that, it can be really useful in a lot of ways, but it can't tell you about the sort of intangible factors that people are kind of mixing in when they're making decisions about where they want to live or whether they want to move for a job. You know, a lot of people have basically said, yeah, I know it's more expensive to live in Chicago, and I'm willing to, you know, shoulder that for certain advantages. You know, a lot of these ads are targeted at people riding the CTA trains in Chicago. So a reporter for the Chicago Reader went and talked to some people riding the CTA. And, of course, some of the ads kind of portray, you know, miserable sort of strap hangers on the train compared with people having a great time, you know, going out to a bar or riding mountain bikes in Wisconsin. And, you know, people made the point that, no, we like being able to ride the train, you know, and obviously for some, I'm sure for some people that's stressful and hectic, but for a lot of people, that's an advantage. You know, they spoke to someone from Wisconsin who was happy to not have to drive anymore, for instance.
Now, one thing you did measure a little bit yourself is what I've decided to call the ramen noodle indicator. Part one of the ads, I understand, shows the Chicagoan strapped for cash eating cheap ramen noodles, the Wisconsinite at a fancy ramen restaurant with all the money they save with our lower cost of living.
Right. I'm fascinated by this video ad. And of course, it's a trope, right, that people who are broke go buy the little Maruchan ramen packets and boil them up at home. And of course, there's in just about every city, there's these new ramen restaurants popping up that make, you know, these really gorgeous bowls of ramen. And so I was trying to just figure out, well, I mean, it's an ad. Obviously, they're making a point in a very short amount of time. There's going to be an element of hyperbole and whatnot. And I totally get that. I'm not humorless. But it was kind of funny to me because, you know, if I asked a friend who lives kind of in Logan Square area in Chicago, like, will you just duck into your neighborhood grocery store and tell me what, you know, Maruchan ramen packets are going through for? And, you know, it's something like 50 cents, whereas I think around here it's usually like 20 or 30 cents.
Yeah,
depending. And, you know, there's I can't speak to Milwaukee because I don't live there, but, you know, in Madison, there's a couple of really great ramen places that you can go out to and, you know, drop a hefty dollar, I think, to have a decent meal. So it was just kind of funny to me that was portrayed as a trade-off, because that's something that's going to be, you know, kind of a similar spread wherever you go, I think.
Now, you talked to some economic development experts for this story. What was the sense about the effectiveness of marketing Wisconsin as a lower cost of living place? Did they feel like this is something that's going to lure a lot of targeted young professionals to cross the border?
Well, I think the jury's still out, but the broader background of all this is that, you know, it happens as Wisconsin is really struggling to hold on to and attract young workers, you know, especially, you know, of the kind that might, you know, work at a technology company or what have you. I mean, obviously, there are some exceptions to that, but there is that long-term trend of a lot of parts of Wisconsin are aging, losing population, and, you know, really trying to figure out how do we retain people, you know? And so it's not clear yet whether the argument that Wiedek is making in these ads is necessarily going to be successful and, you know, convince people that this is the right trade-off to make for them. You know, and one economist that I talked to made the point to me that, you know, people are getting less kind of mobile overall, which I found really interesting. You know, does this experience of moving to take a new opportunity is, you know, I'm wondering, is that something that resonates with fewer people now? I'm kind of really interested to figure that out.
We'll leave it there for now, Scott, and plan our next WPR ramen and bowling party.
All right. Thanks so much, Rob.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. He joined us for a closer look at what goes into calculating the cost of living in different areas and whether it can help Wisconsin draw younger workers into the state. Wisconsin has a long history of sausage making with many small local shops and large plants. And maybe you or someone you know converts their garage or barn or shed or basement or whatever to a temporary sausage producing workshop each year. Our next guest says more Wisconsinites are getting into the act and it's worth it. Jeff Sindelar is a UW Extension meat specialist and an associate professor at the UW-Madison Meat Laboratory. He's led more than 100 meat and food seminars and makes sausage at home. Jeff, thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm guessing a lot of people like me might remember their grandparents. You know, my grandparents on the Polish side of my family would grind kielbasa right there in their kitchen. It sounds like this is making more of a comeback lately.
It absolutely is. But it should be noted that it's been going on for quite some time. It's just gaining more and more popularity across the great state of Wisconsin.
And I understand you grew up on a smaller farm. What's your own history with making sausage?
I did. So I grew up on a small farm in Nebraska where harvesting animals and converting that into different various meat cuts and sausages were very common.
And I understand there's a couple different threads going on here. Hunters, you know, a lot of times you'd have the deer, you'd take it to the processor, they'd convert it into venison, jerky, sausage, steaks, whatever. More hunters, it sounds like, are doing this on their own now.
Absolutely. There's, you know, definitely a growing interest in this area, and for lots of reasons. We have lots of hunters in the state of Wisconsin, lots of wild game, and when that wild game is harvested, there's tremendous amount of interest to transform that into food, and definitely a sense of pride and excitement taking that journey and saying, I made this with my own two hands. And there's many, many tools, tons and tons of resources on the internet, as well as, you know, at your local hunting and fishing stores, and lots of expertise to be able to help guide people that are interested in doing that successfully do this.
And then there's a growing interest in the last bunch of years in artisan foods, local foods, knowing the source of the food you're eating. Well, what better way to know the source than to make it yourself? So a lot of people, even non-hunters, are finding a source for meat and then making their own sausage.
That's correct. The term local has definitely been elevated in terms of its importance and value. And there's nothing more local than your two hands creating something in the comfort of your home, in your garage, in your basement, with friends and family, and then experiencing that product with those same people after you've made those products.
Talking to Jeff Sindelar, he's a UW Extension meat specialist. He's also an associate professor at the UW-Madison Meat Laboratory. We're talking about a growing interest in making people's own sausage around Wisconsin. And Jeff, let's get into the how. Take someone from 0 to 60 here, someone who's never done this before. What are some of the basics that they need to have in terms of equipment and space?
Sure. So it can be very, very simple. So you can make sausage in your kitchen if you've got the right tools. And those tools really are, of course, having the meat. And they don't have to be from game animals. You can go to grocery stores or supermarkets and buy various cuts. You need some way of reducing those piece of meat into smaller ones. We call that particle reduction. And that can be done very simply with a small grinder, which you can spend just a few dollars on, that clamps on to perhaps your kitchen workspace. Or you can even buy small attachments. Let's say you have a mixer, such as a KitchenAid mixer in your home, that you can purchase an attachment. Or you can get a little more extravagant and spend more money and become more proficient. You know, perhaps you want to produce higher volume goods. So you have to have some of those simple pieces of equipment. You also have to have the ingredients. So we use the same type of ingredients that you might use for cooking a pot roast or some of the other dishes. You need various spices and seasonings, salt and sugar and pepper and garlic and so forth. And then you just need the ability to put that mixture, which can be mixed by hand, in some type of casing or something to give it some shape and form. And then depending on if that product is something that has to be cooked or not, you can either consume it or use some simple cooking techniques to cook that product.
Let's talk food safety a little bit. I haven't made sausage myself, but I cook with meat, raw meat, and I got to admit, I treat it almost like a biohazard. I'm super careful with it. What kind of hygiene tips do you have if we're making sausage at home?
Yeah, great question. So food safety is absolutely important, absolutely critical whenever you're dealing with food, and especially meat. And it's really because of the bacteria that can be present on meat. There's some very simple things that you can do. Some very simple principles that will really ensure that safety, food safety, is always upheld. So temperature is one of our best friends. In the bacterial world, we like to say that life begins at 40. So keep meat at or below 40 degrees Fahrenheit when possible, as long as possible, realizing that when you're working on, you know, making a sausage or doing some cutting or doing some type of processing or manufacturing, you may be doing it in a room temperature room. And so that meat will have a chance to raise above 40 degrees. But as long as you limit and minimize how long that meat is exposed to those temperatures, you don't give the bacteria enough time to grow and really grow to dangerous levels. So temperature is really important. And then we have to think about hygiene. So making sure that we are working on clean surfaces, that we are washing our hands, that the utensils that we're using are clean, that helps us make sure that we're not contaminating the meat, or the third point, controlling cross-contamination. So control your temperature, control your environment, so make sure that you're working in a clean environment, and then ensure that you are not cross-contaminating other areas, other utensils, other surfaces during your manufacturing.
So this might be actually a good reason to use that shed or garage or outside space in the winter if you don't mind working in the cold a little bit. That's going to actually help with the hygiene side of things.
Absolutely. Generally, in a wide open work environment, a space that might be segregated from other activities, especially food preparation activities, those are usually really ideal places and locations to make some of these products.
Well, let's make some brats, being in Wisconsin. Talk us through the ingredients that go in there.
Brats are a very unique product. They, of course, are mainstream here in the state of Wisconsin. And it's very interesting. More bratwursts are manufactured in the state of Wisconsin than any other state in the United States. And this should be no surprise, right? They're really the bread and butter of the meat industry in the great state of Wisconsin. So bratwursts are very, very simple to make. We take some type of meat. We need to have a little bit of fat included. Fat is important for both flavor and texture. Having some fat in a meat batter, as we call it, or a sausage recipe, helps make sure that you have a really great eating experience. So we want to have a meat mixture that has roughly 15 to 20% fat. So if you kind of use the analogy of when you go out and buy a hamburger, ground beef, and we have the different fat variations, you know, you can buy like 93% lean and 90% lean and 85% lean. Whichever those variations that you like, or whichever variant you like of ground beef to purchase and consume in your household, you really want to target that amount of fat for a bratwurst because it'll be exactly the same. And then we have to grind those raw materials into small pieces, of course, the consistency of a sausage. And then you simply need to add some basic ingredients. So we add a little bit of salt. We add a little bit of sugar. We add a few spices, usually black pepper, garlic, and then you can build upon that and then make your bratwurst very unique and special to what you like.
Are a lot of people taking this to a step two and then smoking the sausage that they make, either into a smoked kielbasa, hate to keep going back to that, or other kind of smoked sausage?
Sure, absolutely. So fresh sausages are the easiest, primarily because you don't have that cooking component. If you want to take that bratwurst, that fresh bratwurst, and make a cooked bratwurst, then you want to add one additional ingredient, and that's water. And the meat industry uses water in a lot of sausages, not to make them cheaper, but to make them high quality. Because when we cook meat, when we cook sausage, we lose some of that water, we lose some of that moisture. And the same occurs if you are making these cooked sausages in your homes. So you take that sausage, that recipe, you add a little bit of water, maybe 10 or 15% of the total weight. You stuff it into a casing, and then you cook it carefully so that you create a very different product than what a fresh bratwurst would be.
As we wrap up, if people out there listening are thinking, yeah, I do want to try this at home, are there resources out there in Wisconsin to help people get started?
There are tons of resources. So you can simply go on the internet and search for making sausage at home. You can navigate to my website, which is University of Wisconsin Meat Science Extension. There are tons of books available for sausage people or those interested in making sausages at all different levels, and there's many workshops that are held around the state to teach people these practices.
And what is your next project, or maybe your most recent project at home that you've made?
So I like to get together with friends and make dry sausage. So we like to make Genoa salami and pepperoni and hard salami and calabrese and those types of things. We get together and have a great time. We usually have a few vibrations just to make sure that we can get through the event. But it's a wonderful social opportunity. It's a wonderful means of having fun and making something and then sharing that end product with all of our family and friends.
Sounds fantastic. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet. It was a pleasure being here.
I've been talking to Jeff Sindelar. He's a UW Extension meat specialist and associate professor at the UW-Madison Meat Laboratory. He joined us to talk about making homemade sausage. If this is something you do, if you're doing it maybe even this weekend, tell us about it. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.